You might have heard that the Metallica boys were gonna play some heavy shit tonight.
Welcome to another edition of Metal Tales. I'm Ethan Luck. I'm here with Mr. Graham Smith, and the reason Graham Smith is here is because he's a patron, and that's one of the perks. You get to be on an episode of Metal Tales and talk about basically any show you want, past, present, maybe a future show that didn't even happen yet. Who knows? But Graham Smith is here. Graham, thanks for being here, my friend.
Hi, Ethan. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. I see we're both drinking a cup of coffee. You've got a much cooler mug than I do. It's a Metallica mug.
It's actually herbal tea.
Herbal tea. Okay, true. You are in England, so I should have assumed it would be tea.
Yeah. I normally drink coffee, but I thought I'd coffee would just send me a bit wired if I had some coffee.
You're trying to be extra English this morning, right?
Yeah.
I have a mug that is from this place north of us in Kentucky called Dinosaur World, where there is a bunch of fake dinosaurs you can take kids through, and it's pretty hilarious. When you drive down the freeway, you can see them poking out of the trees and stuff.
Yeah, there's a park like that in South London, Crystal Palace Park. Far from where I used to live. Same kind of thing.
Wow. Well, maybe one day, next time I come through England, I'll have to check out that Dinosaur World. I've been to all of them. this one's going to be a really fun episode because, like we were talking before we started recording, in general, the Metal Tales are, you know, obviously talking about the Worldwide Tour as it was happening. And in these last couple of weeks, as we're kind of cataloging a lot of these to put out over the next few months, we're starting to dip back a little further and stuff like that. So, some are still going to be the Worldwide Tour because there's a lot of listeners that was their first time seeing Metallica. But you, Graham, are an exception because we're talking about Donington 1985, which is the Monsters of Rock Festival, which was ZZ Top, Marillion, is that how you pronounce them? Marillion. And then Bon Jovi, Metallica, Rat, Magnum, and Tommy Vance, who says he was a DJ apparently at this festival.
That's right, yeah, he was.
But this is pretty exciting because this is going to be the first time we've talked about such an older show, and this was still with Cliff Burton.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I can't. I'm glad you mentioned the bill. I could never remember which way around it was, whether it was Rat, Metallica, Bon Jovi, or Bon Jovi, Metallica, then Rat. I know they were sandwiched in between the two of them.
Yeah, I feel like what I'm looking at is probably the it's not an alphabetical order, so it's probably the lineup, meaning Tommy Vance first, then Magnum, Rat, Metallica, Bon Jovi, Marillion, and then ZZ Top.
Okay, so yeah.
So yeah, they were sandwiched between Rat and Bon Jovi, and this was back in the Kill Bon Jovi era,
exactly,
which is hilarious. But we'll definitely obviously, you know, get into that show, just that experience, you know, reflecting back on seeing a show with Cliff Burton, and I know that wasn't your only one. Let's have everyone get to know you a little bit and your Metallica story, and you know how you got into the band and where and when, first record, all that stuff.
Well, yeah, I was just trying to work out. I remember the first time I heard them was like there was a pirate radio station in London called Alice's Restaurant. And I remember there being in my girlfriend's parents' house when I thought it was probably either late 83 or early 84, because I remember they played Four Horsemen and I was blown away. And then straight after it, they played, I think it was something from Rat Out of the Cellar. Something like You're in Trouble, but that I just looked that up, and that only came out in March 84. So maybe this was kind of around March, April 84. So before Ride the Lightning came out.
Wow.
Because I remember I'm pretty sure I went and bought Kill 'Em All on the back of that. I just heard this music, and I was still am a massive Sabbath fan. And it was just like a supercharged version of Sabbath.
Yeah.
And I just remember that the chugging riff in the middle. It just reminded me of like Children of the Grave sped up.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, and you know, back in those days, I mean, the you know, obviously there's the new wave of British heavy metal, you know, with Iron Maiden, Saxon, all those bands. We had Black Sabbath, But you know, Metallica was something different, and you were there. I mean, in those early years where your mind was being blown by this new sound. Like you said, it was a supercharged Black Sabbath.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd read about them in Kerrang for about a year before that. I think it was Xavier Russell and Malcolm Dome in Kerrang that were they were always going on about them, because they actually, around about the time that I first heard them, that February, March 84, they were supposed to do a tour with, it was with Rods and the Exciter, and the ticket sales were so bad that they cancelled the tour.
Wow.
But they came over anyway, and they played two shows at the Marquee. I think they were about 2 weeks apart. And maybe I'd heard them just after they'd played those shows, so I didn't go to those.
Yeah.
Obviously, I wish I had. I know they played, it was around Christmas 84. And I'm quite embarrassed to admit that I actually went Christmas shopping with my girlfriend, because rather than go to see Metallica, which is, and this was, you know, 6 months after Ride the Lightning was released, I don't have many regrets in life, but that was one of them.
Well, hopefully during that Christmas shopping trip, you bought Ride the Lightning, unless you already owned it at that point.
Oh, I already had it.
Yeah.
And I can't, for the life of me, think why I decided to. I mean, I didn't want to go Christmas shopping, but I don't know. There was this. I can't really explain that.
Yeah. What was it?
Maybe I shouldn't have admitted it. Sorry.
What was it like? You know, you heard, you know, you read about them in Kerrang. You got Kill 'Em All. You were blown away by it. And every Metallica fan knows, like, the production quality and the songwriting quality stepped up like crazy on Red Lightning. Was that pretty surreal to, like, put on Red Lightning and all of a sudden hear, you know, Fight Fire with Fire and be like, oh my gosh, this is even better?
It was, yeah. I mean, I remember liking Ride the Lightning more than Kill 'Em All. And so I'm really trying to, I mean, it's hard to remember. I mean, we're talking about like 27, 28 years ago.
Right.
I think that I bought Kill 'Em All first and then Ride the Lightning, but it might have been the other way around. It might have been, because I remember going to there was a small record shop in Croydon where I lived, and the guy had a white label copy of Ride the Lightning.
Wow.
And we'd go in and he'd play a couple of tracks at lunchtime. So that would have been, that would have been sort of like June 84.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I've forgotten your original question now.
Oh, just, you know, your reaction to hearing Ride the Lightning for the first time after only getting Kill 'Em All.
Definitely a step up. I mean, I remember 1984 was a great year for metal. I mean, you had Iron Maiden, Power Slave. There was just a lot of great metal albums released that year.
Yeah.
And around those, you know, 83, 84. But yeah, Ride the Lightning was definitely a step up. Not just all the thrash stuff. And then I had a couple of friends that were like, oh, it's not as good. Not saying they'd sold out, but believe me, there were people back then, oh, they got acoustic guitars on Fade to Black. No, they've sold out. There were people saying that then. So the sellout thing is, I've heard it all before.
Man, what's funny is it wasn't too long ago, maybe just in the last few weeks, because we've talked about, you know, that whole thing. There were Kill 'Em All fans that couldn't believe there was acoustic guitar on Fade to Black. Mm. But I had Kill 'Em All on my turntable in the other room one morning while I was just making coffee and breakfast. And all of a sudden I'm listening to, I think it's Phantom Lord, and there's a bridge section, and there's acoustic guitar there.
You're right.
And I'm like,
and also at the beginning, sorry to interrupt you, in the beginning of Phantom Lord, it's like it's a keyboard.
Yeah.
That. So they've got a keyboard. And as you say, there's definitely in the mix, you can hear, and you can hear that it's an acoustic guitar rather than a clean sounding electric guitar.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I remember, and it's one of those things that I've known, it's always been there, but it just dawned on me that one day, I'm like, wait a second, all these dudes back in the day were complaining about that, and it was there the whole time on Kill 'Em All.
And then skipping forward to Puppet, it says that very first note of Sanitarium is a piano.
I think it's piano and guitar, yeah.
It's piano and guitar, not just...
but there's that really low, it's that low E note, and
yeah,
there's a certain frequency in that which you don't really get from a guitar, and yeah, and so there's a piano in that. I mean, that record starts off with nylon string guitar, you know, classical guitar.
Of course, yeah.
But it just, I mean, you know, as we all know now that it's, you know, 2021, it's like we all know that, you know, going back and listening to Kill 'Em All and to Ride the Lightning, we understand the trajectory they were on to become what they are today.
Yeah.
That's amazing, man. So you were mentioning like Iron Maiden, stuff like that. Were you back in those days just listening to metal only for the most part?
I would say so, because I used to be into when I was about 14, 15, which is 79. I was listening to new wave stuff, like Sex Pistols, Boomtown Rats, The Jam, Squeeze. And then a lot of those bands, they went in a slightly softer direction.
Sure.
So you can hear it if you listen to The Jam albums, that their later albums are a bit more, I mean, now you listen back and think, oh, actually that was good music.
Yeah, right.
At the time I was like, nah, it's not.
It wasn't punk anymore.
It's a bit kind of wimpy.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's, well, not really sort of punk. Well,
and that had to have been an exciting time, and like growing up in England, I mean, I think about that a lot, because, oh, yeah, you know, I got into The Clash and the Ramones and stuff, Sex Pistols, The Jam, in probably early high school, so about, you know, 13 years old, 14. And yeah. The older I got, the more I'm like, man, I couldn't imagine being this age but living in England or in like New York City when all that stuff was just exploding in the late 70s.
The funny thing about, not the funny thing, but the punk rock was, people think it was this massive scene and it killed, you know, they say, oh, punk killed prog rock or killed stadium rock. But in London, it wasn't a massive scene.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like there was a group of people, I think it was in Bromley in Kent, not far from where I lived. I was just a kid at school. I was a little bit too young to go and get involved with all that.
Right.
But it really wasn't this massive scene where everywhere you went, there was punks.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, people would buy the records at school and share records and tape stuff. But it wasn't this a massive scene that I think people have kind of built it up in their heads that it changed everything.
Yeah.
But it was a great time to get into music. And then sort of around, I suppose, yeah, it was about 81. I just remember a lot of the stuff that I was listening to, it just got a little bit, we just went in a different direction. And then I heard people at school were into metal, AC/DC, Motorhead, Sabbath. Maiden hadn't really come along then. They would have just been starting, I suppose. And I can't remember that. I think I just went out and bought a metal single, and it was actually Samson.
Okay.
And the singer was Bruce Dickinson.
Crazy.
So I bought a Samson. I think it was just a single, and I'd never heard them. I just saw this cover, liked their cover. Oh, like, that's a cool logo. Bought the single to get home. I didn't. And then a couple of years later, he turned up in Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
So, and then I got massively into Sabbath. There was a time when I was just listening to Sabbath, the first eight or nine Sabbath albums,
yeah,
just constantly. That's just all I listen to, and then just learning the songs on guitar.
Yeah, so you're also a musician then?
You could call me, yeah.
do you still play guitar though?
I've got my guitars lined up, and I have actually, now I've got my guitars set up in this room, and I've got like GarageBand on my Mac.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have been messing about with stuff, but nothing serious, not in bands.
Oh shoot! I mean, it doesn't matter in what capacity, in my opinion. You know, if you're, you know, like you're in me and Clint's position where we are, I've been touring musicians for a long time, or you're just playing at home. It's like I just get excited about people playing in any capacity, no matter what age.
Oh yeah, at that time I was probably around 81. I started playing guitar, learned all the Sabbath stuff. The lead stuff was not something I was very good at, so I just I actually just got a wah pedal and just thought, well, you can just play pentatonic scale and it sounds okay.
Right, exactly. I mean, shoot, that's a lot of, you know, Kirk Hammett stuff, especially in the Black Album era. You know, it's it's the blues scale, the pentatonic scale. And you know, there was an era of Kirk where, like, I mean, there's stuff I still can't play that he does. Like, all the solos on Justice and Puppets, like, I can't do that. But when and when the Black Album came out, or some of the stuff on Load and Reload, it was like, oh, wow, like, I can, you know, I consider myself a good guitar player, but I'm not a shredder by any means. But yeah, that's the beauty of Kirk Hammett. And when he went a little more simple with his leads, was like, oh, wow, I can actually play that. Like, and not just the rhythm of James's part. So, you know, like, or even James's solos, he usually takes, like, you know, the more mellow solos, like Nothing Else Matters and stuff. And it was like, oh, my gosh, I can finally play a Metallica solo.
Yeah, well, his stuff, he does the, he takes his first solo in Puppets, doesn't he? Is it the first solo?
Yeah, I think, sure, he does. I think Puppets was one of the first ones, yeah.
I mean, a lot of the stuff on the Puppets was the sort of stuff I was trying to learn. I mean, just trying to learn the riffs was, that was enough. Just learning those riffs. Like, you know, this Kill 'Em All, I have to say, is the, I'm not saying it's easy to play, but it's easier.
Sure.
So when we started a thrash band in 87, we were just doing mostly Metallica covers.
Yeah.
I haven't got a tape of us playing those, but.
Oh man. What was your thrash band called?
Resentment.
Resentment. That's a good metal band name.
Yeah, we did a couple of demos. We played gigs around sort of Brighton, and the kind of on the south coast. Then we did one up in actually about 10 miles away from where I live now, Coventry.
Oh, cool.
That was a thrash metal all day. We probably didn't take it seriously enough. There were so many thrash metal bands then.
Yeah,
it was just everyone was just basically trying to be Metallica or Slayer or Anthrax or Megadeth.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a mixture of both. So there wasn't much originality, but it was good fun.
That's exactly how it was over here too. I mean, obviously, I was pretty young in the '80s. I was born in '78, but even in the '90s, I mean, there was still bands still trying to sound like Metallica and cover bands, and then, you know, when there was like the second wave. That explosion of punk rock again in the early 90s with Green Day and the Offspring and stuff, all of a sudden you had a million other punk rock bands, you know. That's just how it works. You know, there's a couple that get really big and everybody else wants to do that.
Yeah. So if you're in a band, if you're just doing it for fun, it's fine. But if you're actually trying to get somewhere, I mean, a couple of bands that we played with, a band called Slammer, and they got signed to WEA Records in 1988, 89, they released an album and then they got dropped.
Oh, wow.
And they were just accused of kind of, oh, you sound too much like Testament and Anthrax and Metallica. And they were like, well, that's the bands that we love.
Yeah, exactly.
Their first album, it's a great album. They were nice guys. They just got, you know, shafted by the record industry. The record labels all wanted to sign their particular UK thrash metal band, thinking they've got the next Metallica.
Yeah.
None of us were the next Metallica. But
right. There's only
couldn't
one.
Couldn't write songs like that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's such a common tale with bands getting signed just based on a new popularity of a certain kind of music. You know, obviously by late 80s, you know, Metallica, without the help of TV, you know, MTV at that point, obviously the one video, but I mean, it was getting big and big and big and bigger. So yeah. I'm sure all the labels were looking for the next Metallica, especially after the Black Album, of course. But, and that was a weird time too, because you had the Black Album come out at the same time, you know, I'm wearing a Nirvana shirt here, like Smells Like Teen Spirit. And it's like both those records exploded. And so metal and that grunge thing kind of took off. And then every label's looking for those bands at that point.
Yeah, they totally did. Yeah, I remember that well, sort of 91. And then for a few years after that, a lot of bands, big bands as well, were just trying to recreate the Black Album.
Mm-hmm.
Like Testament did it with, I can't remember the name of the album, but it came out in 92. You know, they just went for that formula that had been successful for Metallica. Megadeth went in that direction as well. You can't blame them.
Sure, of course, yeah. I've mentioned this on the show before. I mean, You know, everything goes back to Metallica. You know, it's like, you know, Megadeth has their Saint Anger and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, once, you know, Megadeth did Countdown to Extinction and Anthrax did Sound of White Noise, and even Persistence of Time started to change a little bit.
Well, Sound of White Noise was I remember when you, because that used to be my favorite Anthrax album.
Yeah.
you know, I'd been, that actually been the second time I saw Metallica. They were supporting them in 86 and then 87. So I'd seen them a lot of times. Among the Living, great album. State of Euphoria, not so much, but because it was a little rushed. But then, yeah, Persistence of Time, great album. And then when Sound of Night, they got John Bush in. I already liked Armored Saint. I loved it at the time. It was funny that when I listened to your Explore the Big Four episode,
yeah,
I listened back to it. It was like, I don't like this as much as I'm not saying you spoiled the album for me. But I thought, yeah, that Clint and Ethan are right. It's kind of, they had that, they kind of went, well, they got Dave Jordan in to produce. So they went for that kind of grunge sound. Because Anthrax did tend to do that. They're a great band, but they did kind of hop around on different bandwagons, if you like.
Right, yeah, they definitely did that
throughout the 90s. I'm not slagging them off, but they kind of, they like to go with whatever's popular in a way. But so I really liked the album, Sound of White Noise, at the time. And now, looking back, I much prefer Among the Living.
Yeah, I mean,
I think that's stood the test of time.
It absolutely has.
I remember thinking in 93, 94, everything was quite serious, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Music was quite serious. A lot of it was, metal was. But, you know, because you had like Soundgarden had come along. And so the kind of stuff like Among the Living, you know, with the Bermuda shorts and the skateboards and all that, it was kind of seen as a little bit cartoony.
Right.
But it's funny that now, looking back, Among the Living, for me, that's definitely their best album.
Yes, I agree.
It sounds great. You know, I still like Sound of White Noise. There's some really great stuff on it, and I love John Bush's voice. I don't think it's aged as well as their sort of classic sort of 80s stuff.
Yeah, you know, and you brought up State of Euphoria. That's also one of my favorite Anthrax records, even though it was rushed. But I didn't know that for so long. So to me, it, you know, when I found out, it didn't really make a difference. I'm like, okay, I've been listening to this record since I was in, you know, seventh or eighth grade, you know, my early teens. So yeah, it doesn't really matter to me. And I don't know if you have, I've been watching those Anthrax webisodes they've been doing about their whole history. And
I haven't actually,
no. Oh, they're great. They're all for free on YouTube or even on their Instagram account. I think they're up to like 20 something episodes. It's really cool, and it's all kind of like what we're doing. It's all like they're all over Zoom and, you know, talking about the history of the band and showing footage. It's just like a documentary of their whole career, and they even talk about, you know, Sandy Ford being rushed. They talk about the stuff in the 90s about, hey, look, we have to change. Like, we're already getting buried by this music. You know, everything's darker. It's not as, you know, we can't be our goofy selves like we used to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the last time they were able to do that and be successful with it was when they teamed up with Public Enemy for Bring the Noise, which I always loved that cover of the two of them together.
So when was that? I'm trying to think, but that was kind of,
that was 91, I think.
It was 91. Yeah.
Attack of the Killer Bees.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I'm not slagging Anthrax off. Don't get me wrong. It's just a kind of observation that having listened to your episode,
Oh, I never, you know, and everyone, you know, everyone's got their flavor, man. I mean, you know, there's Anthrax records that I don't care for. You know, I mean, I love Spreading the Disease. You know, obviously, State of Euphoria and Among the Living, and Persistence. There's probably five or six records in a row that I really like. You know, and there's a couple John Bush records that I'm like, it's good, but it didn't capture me like those other records did. You know,
me neither. I think there was the one, was it Stomp 442, the one directly after Sound of White Noise. I remember being really disappointed by that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple good gems on there for sure, but yeah, I mean, it is interesting though, and I know this feeling of being in a band and kind of seeing the music landscape change around you, and you're still doing something that maybe was more popular a couple of years ago. So it's a tough balance of finding, and I'm sure Metallica dealt with this too, but it's a tough balance of finding, like, okay, we do want to adapt and grow as a band and be different. I mean, shoot, the Beatles did it, but but, you know, how do we do this without coming across like we're doing it on purpose in a way? You know, it's like, yeah, we are making that decision to change, but we still want to stay true to ourselves in some sort of way. And I mean, I think Metallica did a great job of it, even though, you know, they got heavily criticized for the change in the sound, even on the Black Album, you know, which is, listen back now, that album is just heavy as shit.
Metallica, they're kind of unique. They really, they get criticized for whatever they do.
Yes.
And as I said earlier, people in 1984 were saying, "Nah, they sold out acoustic guitars."
Right.
And that's just carried all the way through. Oh, they sold out, signed into a major label. They sold out. I don't know. People have just always been on their back, and just more so than other bands. I don't know why that is. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I just always feel there's more kind of people are more interested and more quick to judge them, and like I say, it's all the cries of selling out. It's just been there almost since the beginning.
It's such a stale argument anymore. I think
To me, it's just a joke, really. It's a joke. Oh yeah, they sold out by releasing No Knife Till Leather. They sold out by playing gigs. You could just take it to the.
You really could, yeah. Yeah, James sold out when he answered Lars's ad in the paper. You know, it's like,
exactly.
I mean, to me, there's maybe a couple things that always factor into that. It's usually fans that maybe were hurt by the fact that they signed an electro or had an acoustic guitar in a song or whatever. And that's their preference. That's cool. But I mean, to me, I kind of feel, you know, sorry for those people, because it's like, man, you've missed out on a lot of cool stuff, you know?
Yeah. I know a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
I know people that are friends of friends that are like, no, the Black Album was when they went pop. They're the new Backstreet Boys of metal.
Oh my gosh.
All that kind of stuff. And it's, you think, oh, that's just what people. I know people that will say that.
Yeah.
To my face. Oh no. They cut their hair. I mean, I don't know.
Oh my gosh.
I loved it at the time when they cut their hair. I like the music. But I also enjoyed the fact that it just like pissed people off. I enjoyed that side of it. I didn't just like it because of that. I loved the music. Yeah. I love Load. I prefer Load to the Black Album.
Wow.
Because the Black Album was kind of, when I first heard it, having been a fan since like 84, it was like, whoa, this is a bit different.
Yeah, sure. Of course.
You know, those first three albums are my favorite three albums.
Yeah.
I'd say that probably the favorite is, I don't know, it's either Lightning or Puppets. I don't know.
It's tough.
Say Lightning's my favorite, but Puppets is possibly a slightly better album, but it's such a fine margin. But Kill 'Em All, I love Kill 'Em All.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's just a great album. It's fun.
It's an amazing debut too, man. I mean, for that to be their first record, I mean, especially when you look at the history of them playing their early shows, where they were mostly playing cover songs and maybe one or two songs they wrote, and then all of a sudden they come out with Kill 'Em All, and it's like, oh my god, they wrote all their own songs. It's like, you know, and to your point a few minutes ago, we talked about, you know, pissing people off in the Load era. It's like, that's kind of what Metallica has always done well. Is like they've done their own thing, they make their own decisions, they do what's best for them. And they want to get their music out to as many people as possible, and they've become the best at something. When you're the best at something, people are going to hate you no matter what, no matter how old you are.
Yeah.
Even on Hardwired, people are like, oh, it doesn't sound like this. It's like, oh my god, then don't listen. Just let us have some fun, and you can go complain to your wall at home.
Exactly.
Well, man, let's start to talk about Donington Park, man.
Sure.
The Monsters of Rock Festival. Like I mentioned before we started recording, and it's so weird because this is an older show, it's so weird to see such a short set list of 9 songs.
I know.
So where in relation to where you were living is Donington Park?
Where I grew up in South London, Donington Park is right. It's next to East Midlands Airport, which is kind of between Derby and Nottingham.
Okay.
Which is not probably about 50 miles from where I live now in Coventry. Back then, South London. I think my first Donington was 83.
Wow.
83. I went there because, well, Diamond Head actually opened it.
See,
Diamond Head and then Dio.
83 was Tommy Vance DJ'd all these. Jeez. Tommy Vance, Diamond Head, Dio, Twisted Sister, ZZ Top, Meatloaf, and Whitesnake.
Meatloaf, that was, he got bought off.
Wow.
But yeah, so Diamond Head after they'd gone a little bit kind of experimental with their second album, or third album, Canterbury. Great album, but it kind of aimed it. Well, they kind of sold out. They did a kind of similar thing to Metallica, but without selling many records.
Sure, sure.
But they were great. They were a great band live. They just had... Well, they were managed by the singer's mum, and wow. she refused to. And I can't. It was either Rod Smallwood or Q Prime, so Peter Mensch, or a very famous manager. But, you know, wanted to manage them, and yeah. she refused. Can you imagine that? Metallica being managed by Lars's mum or by Torben.
I know, it's so weird.
But she just refused. She just wanted the control of it. And the band just kind of, they're still going now, but it's a shame because they were a great band.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I'm sure that, you know, the reason they're probably still going, not the main reason, but a good part of it is, I mean, a band like Metallica got so big and exposed so many people to that band. I mean,
definitely.
I've talked about it on the show. I mean, that's Metallica is the reason I ever heard of the Misfits, you know,
me too,
or Diamond Head, a lot of these bands. I had no idea who the Misfits were because I got into metal before like punk rock and stuff. So I had no idea about the Clash and all that stuff. I was gonna say, and then I hear, you know, my buddy loans me a Garage Days cassette, and I got it in my Walkman at school, and I'm like, I think these are Metallica songs. I had no idea
which one, the first, the 598.
Yeah, the original Garage Days. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. yeah.
I totally thought they were, because I didn't look at the liner notes yet, and I was just like listening to it, like, wow, this is so different. And then I opened up the thing, and it was like, oh, wait, these aren't their songs? Like, then who are these bands? And so. This is pre-internet, so I'm just like going to the record store, you know, whether it was Tower Records or the local shop or whatever. And I'm like, hey, do you have anything by the Misfits? And I'm like, oh, yeah, come over here. And all of a sudden, I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. And then I had to get the one that Last Caress was on, because that's the only song I knew. But that's, you know, that's, again, that's, it shows the power of that band, that they've introduced so many, I mean, millions of people to other bands that maybe wouldn't have heard of, or at least not heard of for a long time. But
absolutely. Yeah, definitely the Mis. But you mentioned the Clash. How did you get into the Clash?
Just friends at school. Me and my friends were, you know, into metal and stuff like that. And then we were getting into some weird stuff, like, or maybe what's considered weird back then, like the Chili Peppers and Primus.
Great.
We were always just trying to listen to stuff that we could skateboard to, you know, put our Walkmans on, and like, you know, we weren't listening to anything slow. And then I got into Nirvana and Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, all that stuff. So by that time in the early 90s, I already had a pretty eclectic mix of stuff I was into, aside from what my dad was getting me into. And then one day I just became friends with this dude at school, and he had his sweatshirt on, and he had made his own back patch of the Clash, that classic photo from the first record. And it just looked so cool. And I was like, what is that? You know? And he's like, oh, this is the Clash. Like, they're one of the best punk bands, but they're not really punk, even though the first record was. It's just... And then
there's a lot of reggae on there, isn't there?
The White Man in Hammersmith Palais is, you know, basically a reggae cover. They do Police and Thieves by Junior Mervin.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
And so I just got obsessed with that. And it was because of that that got me into not only punk rock, but like reggae and ska. And then, and then of course, ska blew up in especially in California in the mid 90s. But, I think similar to you growing up in the 70s, I mean, it was a very exciting time, especially in Southern California. A lot of these things were just going crazy and getting so popular with No Doubt and the Mighty Mighty Bosstones and, you know, Green Day from California, Offspring, Social Distortion. There's so many bands to list, you know. So it was, I'm very grateful to have grown up there and gotten into all that kind of music, and then gotten into music from where you're from. And it's music is still a mind blowing thing to me.
Me too. It's, I remember people saying to me when I was like 17, 18, oh, you'll grow out of this in a few years.
Yeah.
And you'll be listening to, you know, I never imagined that at the time, that when I was, you know, 56 years old, I'd still be listening, but Metallica would even still be going.
Yeah.
I didn't imagine that back then, because back then bands would last for sort of like 7 or 8 years. If you're lucky, they lasted for 10 years.
Yeah, a couple records
they'd
maybe.
They'd split up, even big bands. Yeah. You know, like Zeppelin sort of through late 60s to 1980. You know, Sabbath. I mean, Sabbath just limped on through the 80s.
It really did.
Really embarrassing. I can't.
Yeah, there's some weird records in there that it was just Tony Iommi, you know, and some
with Tony Martin singing. And there was, after the sort of the two with Dio, and then Born Again with Gillan, which is kind of okay, that album. But it just became a bit of a joke.
Yeah, I love the
Dio. Which is a shame, because that's my point. Oh, yeah, I love the Dio stuff, absolutely. I love the, you know, but I remember I got into them just after when Dio had done Heaven and Hell with them.
Yeah.
And it was back then, I remember, like, people at school going, I remember a guy back when people, I mean, they probably still do, write, you know, band names on their bags. And he had this, one of the kids at school had Ozzy versus Dio on it.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, what's that? I didn't know what it was. And I asked him, and he went, oh, yes. You know, it's Ozzy. Ozzy was the original singer. He's, yeah, he's the best one. And this new guy, Dio.
That's cool.
It was a real, you know, I listened to them both. I think I bought Heaven and Hell, and I bought Live at Last, which is a sort of a live album, not a bootleg, but an unofficial live release.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, oh, they're kind of different. But I loved them both.
Yeah, for sure.
I didn't think, oh, I can't like Ozzy because I like Dio. I've never been like that. I just like the stuff that I like.
Yeah, if you like good music, then, you know, whatever.
That's what it is to me. And
I mean, shoot, the Blaze Bailey Iron Maiden record, if that was an incredible record, you'd be like, well, it's not Bruce Dickinson or Paul, but it's still good. But that's not a good one, unfortunately.
I mean, I've chatted about that a lot with some of the guys on the Discord, and I'll admit that I just didn't listen to those two albums. I didn't buy them.
Yeah, I tried.
I don't think I heard the first single from X Factor.
And, yeah.
You know, but I've been a Maiden fan since 82.
Yeah.
And it was like really, you know, they'd done a couple of low par albums with Bruce, and then he left. And the 90s wasn't a good time for Maiden.
No, it was definitely not.
That's the
You're totally right.
But until Bruce came back in 99 and then just killed it.
Of course, yeah. I've seen them a few times, and man, they just...
Have you?
Oh, they just put on such a good show. I saw them once the first time I saw them was here in Nashville with Megadeth opening. A friend of mine had tickets and couldn't make it, so she gave me the tickets. And that was the first time I saw them, and I was just like, oh my gosh. This is, and they had all... I think it was all the Power Slave... set.
I think that was around sort of 2008, 2009, would it be?
Yeah,
when they did this. It was somewhere back in time.
Yeah.
Somewhere back on tour or something like that, somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Or was it, I can't remember which one it was, but they do an album and tour cycle, and then they have the when they sort of pick a certain era and go back to that.
Right.
And then they do a tour of all those old stuff. But yeah, they're always good live.
Always, yeah. I mean, even those dudes that are, you know, they're older than the Metallica dudes, and they're still just wearing it out on stage. And Bruce is, of course, in great shape and running and jumping all over things.
Yeah,
it's just
I saw them I hadn't seen them for a few years, and then for about 8 or 9 years, and I saw him in 2011, and I couldn't believe that he was still running about the stage.
Yeah, man, it's crazy.
He was running about the stage more in 2011 than he had been when I saw them sort of 83, 84.
Yeah.
It was just incredible. And they were brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of thought, I was not worried, but, you know, what are they going to be like?
Yeah, you never know, man. I mean,
they were just the same. They were brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Steve Harris is, you know, he's still just, you know, shooting the crowd with his P-bass and stuff. And
the same. Even when Steve Harris just looks the same, doesn't he?
I know, he really does. I guess it's just
it's the same.
It's everything. That chill Bahama lifestyle he's living, I guess. Well, obviously we got a bit off track here, but that's okay. It's all good. Listen, we can visit Tangent City anytime. Back to Monsters of Rock. So what I'm assuming you probably went with some friends or maybe by yourself, I don't know, but kind of describe like what was the feeling walking into this thing? Were you there just to see Metallica?
I just started to explain that, and then I went off on a massive tangent. So 83, I went 84, which was classic year for it. And so it was the third year that I'd been. And back then we used to get the coach from Croydon, which was about 3 miles, but sort of where I worked, 3 or 4 miles from where I lived.
Yeah.
You just pay, and it was something like about a fiver, or you pay something like 18 quid and you got the coach and the coach there and back on the same day, and the ticket for the show. So, I mean, it was, we just went down there at like about, I don't know where it was, 5 o'clock in the morning. It was about 3 hours on the coach. And I think that 85, I was... I'd put an advert in a record shop I think I was playing bass at the time. I was having a massive Steve Harris phase. Switched to bass, learning all the Maiden stuff. And then these two guys who were, all right, they weren't the best guitarist and drummer, but you know, we just hooked up, and then we just used to drink together. And so we went with a few other people on the coach. So having been to Donington, I sort of knew what it was like. You know, I knew the setup, and I was kind of watched the first band, Magnum. They were like an English band. They're from Birmingham area. Mm-hmm. They're pretty good. And then it was Rat, wasn't it? Was it Rat or Bon Jovi?
Rat next.
For some reason, I just can never get those two. I don't confuse them as bands. It's just on that day. I was so blown away by Metallica.
Yeah,
that's what it was. I was just so, and I talked about it. We all talked about it just weeks and months afterwards. Yeah. We were just buzzing. The thing is, hard to imagine a time when people, not everyone was into Metallica. I don't mean everyone, but now they're
it's a household name now.
They're a household name. And back then it was like, and you can hear when I listened to this, the bootleg, which is on the Ride the Lightning box set as well.
Yeah.
And there's people, I don't know if they've edited it out, but listen on my bootleg, I got on vinyl kind of like a year or two later. And there's just people screaming, fuck off at them. Just really, yeah. And around where I was kind of halfway back. And there's a slope down towards the stage, and all the people are chucking stuff and just screaming abuse because they're the proper old school metal fans. And they didn't want to see Metallica. To them, it was just a lot of old noise.
So they're more of the metal fans like of Rat and Bon Jovi, stuff like that.
Not even that, no, because this was before Rat and Bon Jovi were really big. A couple of years later, that you'd get that real divide between the thrash metal fans and the glam fans, as we call them.
Right, yeah, same.
Bon Jovi, Rat. But in 1985, it was, Metallica was new. Thrash metal wasn't really a scene as yet. And it was just, people just liked the trad metal stuff, you know, the traditional kind of AC/DC. The people that were there at Donington were like that, but they were just screaming abuse. And so I just thought, oh, fuck this. Yeah. I just ran down the front. I used to wear, I had my glasses on. I just ran down the front, found my friends like thrashing about in the mud to Creeping Death. And I remember just looking up at this cliff. There's right in front of me.
Wow.
Like about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet away. Just looking up at Cliff, who had dyed his hair. He had dyed the ends red. Just remember that. But I was like headbanging so much. I put my glasses in my jacket pocket, in my top pocket. And I was like headbanging away, and I wanted to have a little look back up the stage. And it was, and down the front, it was all the hardcore. It was how Lego fans were down there jumping around.
Oh, yeah.
Just, that was the place to be. Just Creeping Death, straight into Ride the Lightning.
Man.
It's just mind blowing to just be seeing this band I'd listened to for the last year.
Well, yeah, and that line, lineup too with Cliff, you know, I mean, obviously in the moment, nobody knows what's going to happen, but, you know, I'm sure maybe even right after he passed away or all the way to today, like now I assume you could look back on a show like this and be like, wow, I saw something really special, you know?
I can remember it. I mean, I'm looking at the pictures on the back of the album that I've got sitting in front of me, and I was just right there, right in front of where Cliff and James were.
Can you find yourself in the photo?
I don't think I can. I'll be the guy looking for his glasses in his pocket. I was right down there, and just like being 20 years old and hanging on just Hetfield's every word, and they were just so fired up. They were so, you know, everyone knows what a powerful band they are.
Oh, yeah.
With Cliff, it was just something. Wow, it was just incredible.
Yeah,
actually, on the record, you couldn't really hear his bass so much. But live, it's just that.
It's probably thunderous.
It really was. So did you want to run through the set list?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you kind of already started.
Jumping ahead.
Yeah, please do, man. You kind of already started. Into Creeping Death, into Ride the Lightning.
Yeah, Ride the Lightning, and then. So they sort of just kind of let the note ring out at the end of Creeping Death. And he's just like, fucking Ride the Lightning. And it's like, oh, yeah, straight into it. And then at the end of Ride the Lightning, stopped. And he went into this, it's just this classic rant where he just, we're Metallica. I've got to tell you something from the start. If you came here to see fucking spandex and eye makeup and rock and roll baby in every song, this ain't the fuck. And he was spitting the words out.
Yeah.
This ain't the fucking band. We came here to bash your fucking heads for 50 minutes.
Awesome.
And we're like, yeah. And you get, and while he's saying that, you can hear all these guys in the back going, fuck off.
All these dudes standing back there with spandex on, like, well, come on, man.
And this is the thing, and they were kind of sandwiched in between Rat and Bon Jovi, so it was an obvious.
It totally was. Yeah, that was not, you know, a random thing he said. He knew what he was doing for sure.
No, but I know that he said it because they played Day on the Green in San Francisco about a week or two later. I remember seeing footage from that and being, he said the same thing there.
Yeah.
And being a bit, I thought that was a little special thing for us in England. So, but you know, you don't realize that when you're younger.
I wonder if he did that anytime that they got put on the same bill as one of the glam bands or something. He's like, well, I'm gonna pull out that spandex line again.
It was so good. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It was probably just his part of his stage because he was getting more confident as a frontman.
Oh yeah,
because I've heard this early gigs that I've listened to from the Kill 'Em All box set, and some of it is quite. in between songs, he didn't really know what to say.
Yeah,
it's quite funny. It's quite charming, but you could really see 2 years later how he'd done developed as a front. He had that confidence.
Oh, it takes time too, man. I mean, look, you know, I've always been like the side guy in a band or whatever, but when I started doing my own music, I mean, it took a while, you know, not only just to stand up there and be with the guy singing all the songs, but then it's like,
yeah,
I might have to say something, a little something or two in between these songs, which, you know, it still feels awkward to me, but you know, that, so it takes time and talent. And obviously James, you know, especially in the 80s and 90s, man, he was just like commanding the stage to the point where now he can be kind of chill on stage when he talks, but everyone still listens, you know.
It's kind of, and just, it's kind of funny to hear him, not sit post rehab,
yeah,
how he doesn't swear, because like for me growing up with just sweary Hetfield,
yeah,
it was so unusual
for sure.
Yeah, he doesn't need any of that. Well, back then he was just, you know, he was drunk and whatever,
young and drunk.
It was just like, it was just like pure anger,
yeah,
pure rage, all coming through the music. And it was just quite funny to see him, you know, no more swearing. But then you think he was a dad by then.
Right.
So he's, you know, kind of like on the St. Anger tour. He was, yeah, so that's just how he is now. But he still come up, when I saw him in 2017,
yeah,
he still come on to stage. He doesn't need to do all that swearing and stuff. He's a different person, really.
For sure.
But still just total, he can just control an audience.
Oh, yeah. Man, it had to have been really exciting standing in front of Cliff when they went into For Whom the Bell Tolls. Like,
well, that was it. And that was the,
that's the obviously intro. An iconic bass part.
Oh, well, it was, that was it. He did that, the big, his rant about spandex and eye makeup. And he just said, all right, Mr. Cliff Burton. And then just Cliff just went into his bass solo part, which is kind of a bit of anesthesia, and just him just making it was just amazing just to be up there in front of Cliff doing that. And then they just Lars counted them in straight into Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yeah.
Which was, yeah, I mean, just what a great start. Creeping Death, Ride the Lightning, Whom the Bell Tolls.
Then Four Horsemen. I mean,
I can't remember if Kurt used to do his kind of little whiddly part at the end.
At the end of Bells.
I think he did. I think it was pretty. I don't think Hetfield said anything after that. He just counted, and then into the Four Horsemen. It's like, yeah, which is probably my favorite Metallica song.
Yeah, I love that song.
Mainly because it's brilliant, and because it was the song that got me into them. So it's got that special connection, and then. Over onto its side 2 on the vinyl, Fade to Black. I was a little, not surprised, but at a festival doing Fade to Black was kind of a not a bold move, but I thought they might kind of go for more heavier stuff. That was brilliant. They didn't play acoustic guitars. I know that on when they played at played in London, the show that I mentioned before that I didn't go to, they brought out an acoustic guitar. Wow. I think people were kind of like, whoa.
Whoa, man.
The next time I saw them, they did have, it was John Marshall playing guitar. The next time I was, he played an acoustic guitar for Fade to Black.
Yeah.
But for this one, Donington, it was just on electric guitar.
Which I like that. I like that. There's a lot of those versions out there that I remember. I think the first time I ever heard a live version of it, there was no acoustic. It was just, he played everything on electric. And I always loved the sound of that.
Yeah. Well, I like them both. It sounds.
Sure.
Yeah. So I suppose they just thought it's a festival. We haven't got time to, have a guitar change or whatever.
Right.
Then you've got to change. If you've got an acoustic guitar, then you've got to, because when I was, the next time I saw him, he had it on a stand.
Yeah.
And then obviously just, so it was just, electric guitar. Then Seek and Destroy. I mean, it has another little, not a rant, but I remember him saying something like about senseless destruction. There's nothing wrong with a bit of senseless destruction. Something like that.
Yeah.
Is all the kind of stuff that used to say back then. Seek and Destroy. And it was the, back when Seek and Destroy was just, he might have done, I think they did a little, kind of sing along part, but not like the kind of 18 minute version that you got on the Black Album tour.
So right.
it was pretty, a little sing along part. Then into Whiplash.
Jeez, what a great,
it's
interesting. According to the website I'm on, that they did an encore, which most of the time bands don't do that on festivals.
They did an encore. I'm pretty sure.
It's called setlist.fm.
Yeah, I normally use that as well.
Yeah, it says encore and then Am I Evil and Motor Breath, but
okay.
It's so interesting, but
it was a long time ago, but it was definitely, that's right. They did Whiplash, then Am I Evil, and straight into sort of like the half of Am I Evil that they, I don't think they've ever played the full version. I've never seen them play the full version of Am I Evil.
Right.
I'm sure they have done it. But yeah, and it was just that, and then into Motor Breath.
And then into Bon Jovi.
And then into Bon Jovi, yeah. Which, I barely remember Bon Jovi.
Right.
I love Marillion, who you probably, I don't think many people in America have heard of Marillion.
I've never heard
of
them.
But they were massive over here. Have you never heard the song Kaylee?
Maybe I have. I'll have to check it out. I'd love to, though.
But I don't. They never really broke America. The year before, they toured with Rush in America, and they had quite a hard time because Rush is quite a tough crowd.
Oh yeah,
Rush fans just want to see Rush.
Yeah, exactly.
I love Rush.
Sure, I know when I saw Rush for the first time on the Counterparts tour, Candlebox was opening, and they were pretty popular at the time, and so I knew like their two hits. But I was just like, I was in my Rush phase, and it was like 94, yeah. 94 maybe. And I was like, I just want to see Rush because I know it's going to be they're going to play like 3 hours, and I want to see Neil's drum solo and all that stuff, And
amazing.
Like, get everyone else off the stage. Let's do this.
Oh, yeah. So how did Candlebox go down? Were they kind of?
I think they did well. I think people, it was kind of one of those things, it's the first band of two in an arena, and it's maybe half to three quarters full because everyone's still showing up and everyone's getting beer and food and merch. But I mean, listen, those dudes, to my memory, they look like they're having a good time. They played well, and when they played their two hits at the time, You and Far Behind, that's when people kind of started to light up a little bit. They're like, oh yeah, I know this band.
Okay.
You
know? That's good.
But then of course, once Rush came on, everyone forgot who Candlebox was.
Oh yeah. I think I've seen Rush. I'm just trying to think, but it was, I think 83. In 83, 88, and 92. And the first two times, I'm sure they didn't have any support.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they didn't.
Man.
They might even have done, because I know they had a thing of doing two sets.
Yeah.
So they could not.
They opened for themselves, essentially.
But the third time, when I saw them in 91, '02 that had Primus supporting, which I love Primus.
So that's cool, man.
That was just when Sailing the Seas of Cheese had come out.
Yeah, it's a great record.
So to see Primus and Rush was fantastic.
I mean, I've still never seen Primus. I want to see them really? So bad. Yeah, they're just one of the, that's, I've mentioned this on the show probably too many times, but having been a touring musician since I was 19, there's so many shows that came through Southern California that I wanted to see, but I was gone. I was on the other side of the country or whatever, you know? And so, and same thing with living in Nashville for the last, you know, 16 years, you know, yeah. like the what's now not a crazy famous show, but you know, it's a very notable Metallica show when they played here, on the Death Magnetic tour, World Magnetic, and Lemmy came out and played with them. And
oh, that was in Nashville.
It was in Nashville. Yeah. And I was planning on going to that show, but then all of a sudden I look at my tour schedule. I'm like, nope, I can't go.
So, oh, no.
But I can't complain, man. I mean, listen, like I've gotten to travel the world and that's an amazing thing. And a lot of times I've been at all sorts of festivals all over the world where I get to go walk around and see bands for free. You know, that's how I saw Iron Maiden for the second time. It was a festival in Norway. I was working,
oh, really?
Working with,
oh, wow.
with Kings of Leon. We got there on a day off the night before and our monitor engineer said, hey, Maiden's playing tonight. I know they're front of house guy. We can go pick up our passes and just walk right in and go hang with him. And so that's what we did. So wow. those are the perks of you know what I've done for a living is I get to just go, because you know when you're working for a main stage band, you know your pass will get you anywhere, any stage, you can walk anywhere you want, go through any security. So I would just check out, you know, the schedule for the day, and if there was a band that I really liked, I'd just go walk over and watch them, and I walk up on the side.
Where would you watch them from? Was it a side stage? Or
it depends. Yeah, I mean, there was one time though. There's this great artist that he just passed away a couple years ago named Charles Bradley. Didn't start. He was like a soul artist, and okay. There's a great documentary about him too called Soul in America. But he had this rough upbringing, and always did music, but never made his own record until he was 62 years old.
Wow!
So for about 8 years or so, he was made four records, I think. And I saw that he was on this, and I'd seen him already one time in the States, and I think this is at the festival. It's called Rock Werchter in Belgium.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I was kind of done for the day until that night when the Kings of Leon were playing, who I worked for at the time. And I looked at the schedule and saw Charles Bradley. And so I got our drum tech at the time, this guy Mitch. I said, dude, you got to come watch this dude. He's in his 60s. He just put out his second record. And he's unbelievable. And I had to drag him there. He didn't want to go. And then the second he started, he was like, oh, my gosh. So we watched him out front for a while. And that's when I was like, let's go test out these passes, our laminates on the side of the stage. And so I walked up to security, showed him my pass. He's like, come on. So then we watched the second half of the show from the side of the stage.
Amazing. I've never heard of him.
He's great, man. It's, I mean, if you like, really? If you like good,
I just made a note of it.
Yeah. Authentic, just a good, authentic soul music, Charles Bradley, and all of his records are good. Actually, he has a record called Changes and he covers Black Sabbath Changes.
Oh,
it's like it sounds like a 60s R&B cover, man. I think you'd dig it.
Wow, I'm gonna check that out.
Yeah, it's really good, man. He's one of those guys you can just hear the pain in his voice when he sings what he's singing. You know, it's just from the heart.
Oh, it sounds interesting though. It's a Black Sabbath cover. I'm normally quite I'm such a Sabbath freak that when I hear someone's anything to do with Sabbath, I'm quite not critical.
But, sure.
I'm not so much now, but I know I was when I was in a band in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
We auditioned we were auditioning drummers or trying to find a drummer, which is always quite difficult. You can find a drummer to find a really good drummer.
Sure.
And this one guy came in, and so this was like 95, I'd say. The stuff that we were doing, it was kind of Sabbathy, like sort of like Caius, CSC.
Yeah.
And we just said to this guy, and just like, you know, I think he just knew that we were Sabbath fans, but especially me. And he's sort of like, I think of that, he was trying to impress us. He goes, oh, yeah, I'm a massive Sabbath fan.
Yeah.
I said, oh, yeah, what's your favorite? I said, what's your favorite Sabbath song? And he went, oh, that one on the Wayne's World soundtrack.
Oh, my. Right away, you knew.
Next.
Yeah, sorry.
No, the other guy was like, oh, you said the wrong thing to Graham there. It was kind of a little bit arrogant, but it kind of reminded me of like when, you know, when they were auditioning, when Jason was being auditioned and the guy had come all the way across the country And James just said to him, didn't like the look of his hair, and just went next.
Yeah, totally.
So I was kind of, I was being a bit arrogant. You might think that would
right.
get doing that. But this guy was just, he wasn't a great drummer. But it was just kind of, don't pretend to be a massive Sabbath fan. You didn't have to be a Sabbath fan to be in our band.
Right.
It's just, we weren't particularly great musicians anyway. But, you know, we were just like having fun and playing at local pubs and clubs.
Oh, man. Some people, as musicians, want to try to impress maybe someone they're auditioning for or whatever. And so you'll just kind of say whatever to get in there. But then all of a sudden when you get like, not even quiz, but just like a simple question, like, well, what's your favorite song? Or favorite
that was
record?
It. Yeah, it wasn't. But I wasn't trying to catch him out. It was just, you love Sabbath. And even if he had said, I don't know, it was just the way he just said, oh, that one on the Wayne's World soundtrack.
Right.
Like, okay. Do you know what it's called?
No. Just track 5. Yeah, totally. Oh man, well, dude, listen, man, I really appreciate you doing this as we kind of wrap up here, man. Again, it's just so cool to hear, you know, a firsthand account of seeing a show from so long ago with Cliff Burton there, you know, and obviously, like I mentioned before, it probably seems even more special now after all these years of Cliff being gone.
It really does. I mean, it just kind of happened that I was 19, 20 years old, and then Metallica came along and heard them. So yeah, it was, yeah, looking back, obviously, with what happened a year later, just, yeah, because I saw them in on the Puppets tour, September the 21st, 1986. A few days later, Cliff was gone.
Wow. That's crazy.
I just remember that. I remember to have seen him twice was just, it was just incredible.
That's amazing.
We just used to talk about Metallica all the time.
Yeah.
We just used to really, people were just like, can you not just shut up about Metallica? All you ever go on about is Metallica. Just all the time. It's everything. We were just obsessed with them.
It sounds like me and Clint now.
Yeah. Nice. It's a great thing. It's not a,
right, right.
I love it.
Oh, it's so funny.
It's just that, yeah, now, you know, I've got a podcast I can listen to and realize that there's other people who are the same.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. Awesome, man. Well, again, I really appreciate you doing this. It was really fun to talk to you and again, you know, hear this firsthand account. And I hope everyone enjoyed it. Mr. Graham Smith.
Thanks, Ethan.
Hey, everyone. Clint and Ethan here, and we want to tell you about a little thing called Patreon. Patreon is an easy and interactive way to support the people who make the things that you love.
For as little as $5 a month, you can ensure that Metal Up Your Podcast can continue to grow in quality and content. That's equivalent to a cup of coffee or a beer once a month.
Not only is it easy and affordable, but we've made it a priority since day one to give back to our Patreon community. We've given away deluxe box sets, rare vinyl, Black and Whiskey,
concert tickets to SNM2 and Slane Castle,
all 4 of our Cover Our World Black and EPs, 26 quarantine covers, and Lunar Satan demos,
invitations to exclusive Zoom happy hours, the ability to ask our guests like Jay Weinberg of Slipknot, Lizzie Hale, and members of the Metallica crew your very own questions,
and eligibility for our Metal Tales series, where you can be a guest on Metal Up Your Podcast and tell us all about a notable Metallica show you've been to.
Subscribe to Patreon today and immediately get access to years worth of bonus content.
Thank you for supporting the people who make the things that you love. Peace.
Adios.
I can't talk about it anymore. It's giving me a headache.
Here, take 2 of these.
Ah, Nuprin. Little. Yellow. Different.